There we go.
All right, another Tuesday. It is Tuesday, August 27th, and I am at Southern Dharma Retreat Center in North Carolina. We're starting a retreat tonight that runs all the way till next Monday, so it's virtually a week. It's actually probably the longest retreat that we do. Greg Bergamot is here with me, teaching, as he always does, and waves. He can't see, so I have to translate everything.
Nice.
Steve waves. All the people who know you, Eleanor waves. Okay, all right. So, it's a great gift to be able to teach Dharma and to teach retreats, because, I mean, we all go adrift at times in our practice and in our program, right? And when you're expected to show up and offer something to people, some teachings, if you're adrift, it tends to pull you back to shore a little bit and get you grounded. So I'm appreciating that. I guess I'm saying that I've been adrift a little bit, but it's just part of life, drifting. So we typically start our this class with 20 minutes of meditation, which I will guide, and then and I'll give a little bit of a talk. And I have some themes in mind today, which I hope will be helpful. So, but to begin, I'm realizing now I was looking at Jorgen and I didn't see that Ori was over there. So, Jorgen, did you email me like a long time ago and we had some correspondence? No, okay, it wasn't you. I mean, everybody in Sweden looks the same to me, so that's just the way it is. Just a little anti-racist joke. All right, let's sit. So just establishing your posture, coming into a stable and balanced alignment. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. And just turning the attention inward. So taking some time at the beginning of the sit to just feel your body, feel how you're holding your body. Notice if there are any strong sensations. And then seeing if you can, with the breath, allow the body to soften. Or not. We're trying to force something to happen, but just seeing if by relaxing, sitting still, you can feel a kind of release through the body. Now you might focus on a few key points, like relaxing the jaw, releasing the shoulders, softening the belly, letting the breath move into the belly. We want to really allow the breath to have all the space it needs in the body. And as we move into this process, remembering to bring an attitude of kindness, of gentleness. We're not trying to force anything or make anything happen. At the same time, not resisting anything that comes up. So we could just call this an attitude of acceptance. And the gentle effort we apply is really the effort to feel the breath. And you can feel the breath at the nostrils as the air touches skin, coming in and out. You can feel the breath at the belly as the movement, diaphragm, muscles, rising and falling. We just gently place the attention at one of these points or one of these areas and let that be our home, our anchor to the present moment, that sensation of breathing. Natural for the mind to wander, then we ask it to pay attention to the breath. The breath is so simple, undramatic. The mind often goes back to its habitual tendencies. Worry or planning, remembering, judging, analyzing, all the busyness that we fill ourselves with. Our practice is not to stop that busyness or suppress it, but simply to notice and come back to the breath, back to the simplicity. We don't want to get into a battle with our own minds. We turn meditation into another form of striving and control when it's meant to be about letting go. This can seem paradoxical in some way when the mind is very busy. And we have the idea that we're not supposed to be thinking. Or we see that we are not spending a lot of time with the breath. And yet, accepting the busyness, actually meeting it with kindness, with care and attention, is actually the best way to begin the process of letting go. As the attention becomes a bit more attuned, can learn to be with the breath or the feeling of sitting, even as the mind churns out its thoughts and images. We realize that it can become a kind of background noise, that we can still feel the body and the breath here in this present moment. The enemy of meditation is the belief that something in particular is supposed to happen, and that we are responsible for making that happen. We fall into this effort at control, frustration, self-judgment. Mindfulness means being aware of what is happening. And seeing it in the larger context of wisdom. If everything is impermanent, how can we be expected to control? Our minds are so deeply conditioned that it takes great care, great heart to hold our experience. To hold it without struggle. Without resistance. And yet to find a way to make an effort that doesn't create more suffering, it doesn't create more tension. An effort that is guided by compassion, kindness. Okay, I guess you could hear the bell. And my little traveling bell with me. So again, welcome. I was sharing an article that Lee Brazington sent to me. I was sharing it with Greg this morning and talking about it. It's about a, it seems to be a increasing interest in these blissful meditation states called jhanas. They're very concentrated states, and there was an article in Time magazine, like somebody went on a retreat, you know. I mean, I'll share the article in a little while, but I don't want people to get start reading the article while I'm talking. But the thing that particularly struck out to me about it was this comment by one of the people who's sort of promoting this practice, is that they were practicing meditating for years and it was always a grind. I think they said something like that. And I thought, you know, and that's kind of what informed my guidance this morning, trying to really encourage you not to make your meditation into a grind. And this is, you know, I understand. I know when I started to practice, it was definitely a lot of efforting, you know, and struggle with the difficult states, and particularly a lot of judgment about, oh, my mind shouldn't be wandering so much, or when I get my mind to stop wandering, then I'll be able to really meditate. And these kind of ideas, and you know, that's not quite, you know, how it works. And that's why I was talking in the way I was this morning about non-resistance and kind of acceptance and just allowing, that it's not so much about, you know, stopping thoughts. It's definitely not about stopping thoughts. And it's also not about getting into some particular states. And certainly states can arise, and pleasant states, very blissful states can arise. But first of all, we can't make them arise by, you know, using the right technique, you know, and then really, you know, working at, like, I'm going to build up my muscles, I'm going to go to the gym and lift all these weights, you know, and it doesn't really work like that. It's the internal relationship to our experience that allows for a pleasant experience to happen, for us to enjoy what's happening. And that's why acceptance is so key. And we understand this in the recovery world, because it's, you know, really emphasized in the famous line from that AA big book, "Acceptance is the answer to my problems today." And so when we sit down to meditate, you know, there's this experience of duality, you know, and I think, you know, it's possible to get, move past that to sense more of a sense of unity. But I think in the beginning, we need to learn to skillfully work with that duality, and the key to that, to me, is that so that duality, as I experience it, is there's me, and we can say more about me, and then there's what's happening, right? Okay, and that's, I'm keeping it as general as I can. So typically that means, like, I'm feeling stuff in my body, and particularly I'm having thoughts and maybe some emotions, and those are the things that are happening. And then there's this me that Right. Like, I don't, what's that? Well, that's a, another Dharma question, but it's not really the one I want to address, which just to say that, so th let's just say that the me is awareness. Okay. And the quality of awareness that's engaging the stuff, the thoughts, the feelings, the sensations. And the attitude we often come with is this me needs to get control of that stuff, right? And so that the me becomes this aggressive attitude. It becomes this controlling and ego-driven, it's me thing. And so before we even like look at the stuff, because the stuff is kind of what freaks us out, oh my God, there's thoughts, oh, this sensation, I can't deal with it, oh, this mood, I'm just so depressed or I'm so anxious. It's like, no, oh, we have to turn back on this me, and I'm using that very much in quotation marks because it's not a real thing, but to turn to this awareness and see what is the quality or attitude with which I am engaging the stuff, because that turns out to be the key to what happens in that relationship. If I go at that stuff with aggressiveness, with a controlling attitude, I create more stuff. I create more stress, more tension. Another story comes up, which is about like how I'm not doing this right, or this is so hard, or I'm grinding on my meditation, and meditation is so hard, but it's good for me, so I'll do it, even though I don't like it. And that if we can, so turn to this attitude, to this me, and say, like, what are you doing? In the kindest way, like, what do you think? No, you don't have to control this. You're not responsible. Be kind to yourself. Be kind to this stuff. Don't get into a fight. Don't turn this into a problem. And so that is a real shift, because it's not how we're taught to deal with the world. One of the things that I notice in so many speeches from politicians is that they say, we have to fight. We have to fight. And I'm like, I understand what you're saying. And in certain contexts, of course, we need to engage very strongly and we need to resist. We need to, but in meditation, we don't need to fight. In fact, that's just the opposite of what we need to do. So we have to retrain ourselves to engage with our experience, and in a way that is kind, that is gentle. And we don't have to like be filled with loving kindness and overflowing with compassion. Again, we can turn this into like, oh, like, I need to float away on my, beautiful, loving kindness. It's like, no, just it's one of the things I love about how the Buddha talks about non-ill will. This is how I should train. My mind will remain unaffected, and I shall utter no evil words, nor harbor unwholesome thoughts. Non-ill, just to not be in conflict, to not be in trying to control. But, and this is why acceptance is such a good term for it, because acceptance isn't like, oh, I'm overflowing with like, I love you. No, I mean, I don't love it when my knee hurts. I don't love it when my mind is spinning out. But if I accept it, if I have an attitude of non-conflict, non-contention, non-ill will toward it, then it has a natural process of it just kind of like naturally fades away. And, every once in a while, I remember to come back to my breath, and I breathe and I feel my body, and maybe I feel the tension that's happening because I'm trying to strive and control. And for one breath or a couple of breaths, I relax. I settle back. I mean, I'm doing it right now because I feel like even talking about this, I got my shoulders came up, like my body got tense because I'm like talking about this. And I breathe and I come back. It's like, oh, it's okay. And 10 seconds later, I'm off again. But I'm not in this battle. Every time I notice I'm thinking, I don't go, ah, there I go again. No, it's just like, oh, hi. Yeah. And even to smile, to realize, oh, there you go again. I don't have to get into a debate or a judgment about it. My dear late friend Wes Scoop Nisker, I remember years ago in his Wednesday night meditation class in Berkeley, back in the 90s. One night, I don't know if it was in response to a question or if it was part of his talk, but he said, if you're not enjoying meditating, you're doing it wrong. And I loved that. And I realized, like, there's a lot of people that are going to hear that and they're immediately going to go, oh, I'm doing it wrong. It's like that is taking what he said in the wrong way. He's not telling you, oh, you're doing it wrong. You're a loser. He's saying, find a way to enjoy your meditation. So the question becomes like, well, how do I find a way to enjoy my meditation? So there's a few things we can point to. One is to, when you, in the pleasant moments, be very intentional about bringing mindfulness to that pleasant experience. Be like, oh, wow, I feel relaxed right now. Just one set for 3 seconds, I feel relaxed. A pleasant thought comes up. Oh, that was a thought of generosity. That was a thought of kindness. Oh, a feeling of just subtle joy or pleasure. Notice that, right? Notice when you come back. There's just such a tendency, again, in our sort of, what do they call it? The ne negative or negative orientation, it's such a tendency to know, to kind of put the pin in, oh, I was resentful. Oh, I was thinking, oh, my knee hurt. Oh, and point out for ourselves all the things that are unpleasant. And to just make this shift, like, oh, let me just notice the things that are pleasant. Is there anything pleasant going on? And this is, I started out by talking about this article about the jhanas, so I'll put it into the, I'm going to put a couple of articles in because they're, this these are from, these are passed on to, from Lee Brasington, from his mailing list. He's a friend and teacher of mine, but and this article in Time magazine is, typical, like the mainstream finds out about some like thing with meditation and they're gonna, turn it into a thing. And great, and then here's another article by somebody who knows a little bit more from Substack. And then here is some research. So people who know other stuff. But this, so this, now I'm going to change topics a little bit. to talk about jhanas and what this article in Time magazine, like, what's the title? It has bliss in the title, or but what does it say? It says, "My week at the Buzzy Meditation Retreat that promises bliss on demand."
Oh my.
Yeah, well, we call that clickbait. So, right. So it's you want, oh wow, oh wow, I can get bliss on demand with meditation. Well, yes, yes and no. But it's really useful. What's useful about it is to see that, oh, it is very quite possible to have pleasant and even very pleasant states in meditation. And you can even get into altered states. And as soon as you put that out in the mainstream media, what happens? The addictive minds that everybody has goes, gimme, I want it, right? And what I said about this when I saw it, I was like, well, this is just like the ayahuasca thing. It's like, oh, I can get bliss by meditating or by taking drugs, or and we know as addicts the risks inherent in that. And that's not to say there isn't some benefit, but as with ayahuasca, jhana is part of a system. If you want to explore paths like that, you need to develop the whole path. This is, the mindfulness movement is taking one element of the Eightfold Path, mindfulness, out and saying, just do this. And it's skipping over right view, right intention, right action, right speech, right livelihood. Okay. So you've got this disconnected piece of a path that's helpful, but really doesn't work in a fulsome way. It's unintegrated. And the jhana thing that they're offering here is like taking a different piece of the Eightfold Path, concentration, and pulling that out. There's no mention of sila. It's like, that's fine. And going into these kind of states without sila is very risky. It's just setting yourself up. And so I'm kind of trying to hold these two things for you guys today, like joy in your practice. Find it. Let your meditation be pleasant, And I mean, I don't worry about this group because people in recovery get it intuitively. You read, believe me, when most of you read this article, you're going to be like, that sounds really great. And I don't know. Which is basically what it is. It's like, but most people will just read and go, that sounds really great. And they won't get the, but I don't know if that's such a good idea. And what's beautiful about recovery and about blending Dharma and recovery is that it's the whole of the path. We recognize that recovery doesn't happen just by stop drinking, And spiritual practice doesn't happen just by meditating. You have to develop all these qualities, and it takes time, right? That's why we honor people who have a lot of time in recovery, why we honor people who have been doing meditation for a long time, because we understand they've been through a lot, they've experienced a lot, they've learned to balance all these different challenges, the difficulty of meditation, the joy of meditation, getting caught up in the joy, and of course with recovery, you quit one thing and then you realize, oh, but I have all these other unwholesome habits. And at first, we're looking outside ourselves. Oh, it's my, whether it's food or relationships and, work. And then after a while, we realize, oh, but what's going on in my mind? And that's often when people realize, oh, this Buddhist thing with their meditation, that might be a good support for my path. And we realize, oh, the whole thing, that whole external problem actually starts internally. And this is where I have to, where the work brings us, where we arrive and we see, oh, this is the work that has to be done, and the external stuff will actually evolve out of that. But because addiction is so pernicious and dangerous, we have to stop that behavior first before we even can start on this kind of path. But anybody who takes recovery seriously knows that not only do we stop that addictive behavior, we stop lying, cheating, and stealing, and so that there's a whole sila element to it, and the whole, inventory element, examining our impulses, our ways of harming people, the ways of harming ourselves, and we realize that this is a complicated process, and the same is true of cultivating the jhanas, You need to have sila, you need to have right view, because it's very easy when you learn how to get blissed out by meditating. It's really easy to say, well, now I got it. Now I'm just going to do this. And then there's this thing called impermanence. And you lose it. And then you're like, no, I've lost it. What am I going to do? And you fall into the typical cycle, right? Like, oh, now I'm. What's wrong? How do I get it back? But if you come to that with wisdom, it's like, oh, this is really interesting. This is wholesome. I can use this. I can apply this to cultivating insight. And then when, like, I did this practice for a long time, and then it went away. I mean, I just it doesn't happen anymore. My mind doesn't go there, and it's great. It's fine. I got what I needed to out of it. So, a few different topics I'm kind of landing on, but I hope that you can sort of see how I view these together. I mean, again, what I'm arriving at, the whole of the path, right? The whole of the path. It's never wise, and I avoid using the word never most of the time, but I will say it's never wise to isolate one aspect of the path and take that on as your whole path. It just isn't. It's just like, I'll just stop drinking and not dealing with any of the other stuff. It's the same. You wind up with the same kind of problem that you wind up with if you just are mindful, or you just are do jhanas. Like, no, that's not a path. So, there you go. I will offer that to you today. I hope it's been helpful. And if there's anything that was not helpful, I apologize for that. But I am open to comments or questions. And there we go, Deborah. Hi. Seeing you online after seeing you in person.
Yeah, I've been you're talking about meditation, and I've really been curious about my mind outside of meditation. And for a while I was noticing how much I measure, and I can call that unwholesome in a way, because it's greed and delusion, this constant measuring. But I'm noticing another thing I'm doing, which is planning and reviewing conversations. I do that a lot too. And I'm also, to mix it up a little bit, I'm studying, I'm reading a little bit of Rob Verbia on impermanence. And his later talks talk about, everything if you recognize impermanence, you also recognize love. It's not, and impermanence is really, I mean, emptiness is really the middle way. You know, things aren't set, but they're not to, I don't know. I'm just thinking about all this, but then in the middle of all of thinking about this, like I'm doing it, questioning this, but it's like, what a, but what a, I mean, so, I understand some of this is functional, like important. Like if I don't think what I'm going to have for dinner early in the day, even if I have a refrigerator full of stuff, it's going to be cereal because I just can't think at the end of the day. I just even so, but it's like you went a few weeks ago through your whole day and it's very structured about how you do your day and what you're thinking. It sounded very structured. Like, but I'm just wondering, like, I don't know, I'm a little lost in this. Like, it seems like, okay, in the idea, my perceptions are just my perceptions and they're empty. I don't know if you're fine. And I
Well,
talked to
I
Will
want to go
about
back to
it.
the first thing you said,
Okay.
which is that you've been noticing the thoughts you're having outside of meditation.
Right.
That is fantastic. Like, and but greet those thoughts, try to treat those thoughts as you do the ones in meditation. That is, don't judge yourself for the fact that you have them, but just notice. And then they don't. By noticing them and not trying to do anything with them, they lose a little bit of their grip. And you, it's more like, oh yeah, I do want to think about dinner. And oh no, I don't want to think about my mother or whatever, you know, like just
Yeah,
make
but it's like it's so much fun to th not about my mother like that. I mean, I love
Fine
my,
too. That's fine too.
yeah,
I
no,
mean,
it's fine, but like
there's,
I kind of love planning and I kind of love
yeah.
going through the, you know, debating this and that about a conversation or I kind of love it, but I'm not sure it's so wholesome. I'm just not sure about that
Well,
is the best.
right. So,
Just notice it is what you're saying, which
you're
is what Will
noticing that you have
Kabat-Zinn said.
unwholesome thoughts,
What?
but you're noticing that you have unwholesome thoughts. Like, welcome to the human race,
I
you know,
don't know if it's even unwholesome. I don't.
or
I.
not useful, like that you're
Yeah,
not.
like is this the best use of is you know not of course the best use. That's even a bad phrase. But is this really what I want to be doing, you
I
know,
think
that's
it's a great question.
okay.
And I would just say, you know, you don't have to answer it per se. Allow the questions to be there. You know, and so just putting that aside, you know, when you get into stuff like Rob Berbet is like a very advanced and sophisticated Dharma teacher, and the it's powerful teachings, but you can't swallow that all like out of this book. You know, it's like, okay, that's, you know, great. Take like one little bite and reflect on it for a while, but don't try to like, you know, absorb, figure the whole thing out and hold it all. It's like, it's too much, you know, it's overwhelming. Yeah, generally, I think that's true of it, of any of the really deep Dharma is taken in very small chunks. I mean, I was. There was one, I was reading The Island again on Sunday morning, and there was like one line that really grabbed me in this paragraph. And then I went to Spirit Rock because Ajahn Pasuna was teaching, and it was something he had written. And I got to say to him, like, this one line, you said this, duh, duh, and he knew exactly the line I meant. It was just like, instead of saying things arise and things cease, the Pali, there's no verb, subject verb action going on in Pali. He said it's just
Dhamma arising, Dhamma ceasing. And I was like, oh, it just hit me. And that was enough. Like, I'm gonna work with that sent that line and that paragraph for a while, because it was pointing to something, and I could feel that. But if I go on to like the next chapter and the next chapter and try to like absorb it all at once, I'll just drown, you know.
Okay, thank you. Thank
Yeah.
you.
Yeah, it's nice to see you again. Yeah.
Thank you. You likewise, everybody.
Who else has a comment here? Can't believe I said all that stuff and nobody wants to say anything about it.
Had a comment.
Okay, go ahead, Anne. That's more like it.
I noted in the comments,
Oh
actually.
wait, I'm sorry. I thought it was Anne.
Oh, that's okay. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay, no, go ahead, Tanya. You're unmuted.
Just saying that the whole jhana movement is all seems to be really tied in with industry and making money. You know, that's just an instant red flag for me. Is there an app that you have to pay for? How expensive are the retreats? You know, it's just such a clear red flag for me. That was
Right.
it.
And that's what Tina Rasmussen said in that article. She was like, well, why are they charging so much for it? Yeah, right away you're outside of Dharma principles, right? It's not a Dana-based system. Yeah. And go ahead.
Hi, how come I can't find the raise hand button? Anyway,
I don't know.
weird.
I never raised my hand, so I don't know where it is.
Yeah, you know, have you ever heard of this practice called do nothing? It comes from, I think, down, you know, through Shinzen Young.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I've been learning this practice actually, and it's sort of in line with all of what you're talking about. It's just like when something arises, just notice, don't do anything. It's like just, and it's such a relief to have teaching, to be taught meditation this way now. It's like my practice has been evolving to this where I can just be in the meditation this morning with you and be like, oh yeah, okay. And then it's really difficult to describe a practice, right? When you're in it and things are sort of arise and then you're like, oh, okay. And then it goes and just, it's much more pleasant, truly.
I think it's hard to just step into that for someone who's never meditated.
Sure. Well,
You
yeah,
know,
I don't think I
people
can.
need some
Structure.
grounding.
Structure, yeah.
But like, I first encountered a practice like that at the end of a 3-week retreat when Joseph Goldstein led the Big Mind meditation. It's very much like that. It's just sort of, open awareness. And I noted that he only taught that at the end of the retreat. And as far as I know, that's how he always offers it. He doesn't offer it at the beginning of a retreat. Okay, just start by doing nothing. It's like people are like, what? How do I do that?
Right, sure.
But after a
Of
while, after the
course.
mind has settled a little bit, I mean, this is one of the problems with being a meditation teacher is like, can I take people to where my mind is, or has my mind been trained a certain amount
Right.
that they haven't been trained, so they're not going to be able to just go there with me?
Yeah, I
And
have that question too.
right. And I think it's one of the goals of a meditation teacher is to take people where you are. But you have to recognize that there's some limits to that. And I don't know what they are. That's why I try to get questions from people to find out. I put out my guidance, and then I'm like, so where did you go? What happened?
Exactly.
Where are you now? You
Right.
know,
Yeah. Where's
is
the
that,
mind now?
yeah.
Yeah, no, I hear you. There's got to be some scaffolding and,
Yeah.
you know, it's an art. It's a, you know, so the other thing was when you were talking about notice the pleasant. You know, we're
Yeah.
always sort of focused on the hurt knee or the obsessive thought or whatever, or the conversation that we're rehashing or planning, whatever. And it just keeps coming up lately. I just have to say it out loud. So, you know, the Buddha talks about like the hindrances or the whole teachings of the Satipatthana, really. It's like notice X is there and then notice it's not there.
Yeah,
It's like
that's
a
right.
clear instruction.
That's a good way of putting
Like,
it. I like
to notice that it's not there. Because most of the time it's probably not there. And we miss this space. We don't see that most of, if you look around your room, most of it is space. We just see the objects and we fixate on the object. So I've just been thinking a lot about that instruction, the
Yeah.
absence of a hindrance or
Right. And the non-ill will,
the
right?
non-ill will.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so this is, as you know, like the Anapanasati gives like a different twist on it, where he does point to the pleasant. And it's Satipatthana, it's the four foundations of mindfulness, but it's the pleasant, at least in the first, three of those Satipatthanas, it's the pleasant. You're particularly bringing out the pleasant aspects of those experiences, but it's certainly not pointing to the unpleasant.
Right.
And that practice really develops a lot of concentration. And that's again how you get into the concentrated states is through the doorway of joy, of piti. And that's how the jhanas work. And that's when you look at the seven factors of enlightenment. We can go on here,
Yeah.
it's
Yeah.
mindfulness, investigation, energy, joy, tranquility, concentration. Oh, like and I think that's hard for people to hear when they're struggling with their meditation. Like, where's my joy? I don't have any joy, so I guess I'm doing this wrong. Like, and that's why maybe joy isn't even the right word. Like non whatever, non unpleasant or non
Not joy.
despair or
Right.
non
But you know,
resentment.
but if you look at it, even if you're grumpy and you sit down, there is some joy. There's like, here I am. I'm sitting, maybe I'm with the Sangha, maybe I'm with my people and we're here together, we're supporting one another. You know, it doesn't have to be like what's going on in my mind right now or in my body. It's like, oh, look at these conditions that are set up that I'm able to do this. You'll get to try some of these things out, like joy, tranquility, when I go on my retreat.
Yeah. Wild idea. So just to put a finer point on it, the way Lee Brazington teaches this, which he learned from Ayakama, is that when you're meditating, notice if there's a pleasant sensation in the body. And it can be quite subtle, but it might be in your hands or in your face, could be anywhere in your body, could be in your toes, Notice if there's a pleasant sensation and then put the attention on the pleasant sensation. And try to sustain the attention on the pleasant sensation and keep coming back to the pleasant sensation. That's the way that Ayakema taught getting into the feeling of joy. So which points to the idea that joy isn't just a mental state, right? That what she's talking about actually has a physical component to it. And of course, we know that mind and body are blend together, that when I'm sad, I feel a heaviness and a dullness. When I'm happy, I feel a lightness. And so instead of trying to go there through the mind, she actually takes you there through the body, which is quite interesting.
Yeah.
And I found it very effective because I'm used to being mindful of the body. Right? And it's easy to be mindful of sensations in the body, much easier than it is to be mindful of thoughts or emotions, which are more subtle.
Like
So
that.
that's a note to end on.
That's good.
I'm going to hang out with Anne afterwards. So I will say adieu to everyone else. I will see you again next Tuesday when I should be, God willing, I will be back in Berkeley. And I wish you all a wholesome, happy week. Take
Thank
care.
you, Kevin.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. And you should turn off the recording.
Thanks. Namaste.
Thanks, Monica.
Thanks, Kevin.